Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. And before I introduce him, we're just going to watch 60 seconds of a video. Isn't that amazing? We will give you the story about that video. It's called Someone Special. And now I'm going to introduce Marty Strong, who is a retired Navy SEAL of 20 years. He is the author of 9 novels and 3 business books and is a CEO. Welcome, Marty.
Hello, Hillary.
All right. So Marty, I'll just give them a little background. Marty sent me his book, Be Different, which is launching this week that the interview is going to be aired. And I just read it. And this book, the subtitle is How Navy SEALs and Entrepreneurs Bend, Break, or Ignore the Rules to Get Results. So, and when we first talked, he said it's about people getting creative because we've kind of stopped as we get older. Kids are creative, right? And then as we get older, we get a little careful or something. So do you want to tell them how that, the story about the film? Why not?
So Someone Special is the title of a recruiting film. It was the very first recruiting film when President Reagan became president. He wanted to expand some of the areas of the military, including special operations. So he directed that that the Navy create more SEALs and that the Army create more Green Berets, just like that, with a, you know, piece of paper, stroke of a pen. And I happened to be at the training center for the SEAL teams. I was an instructor. I was the chief in charge of the first phase of SEAL training, which is where all the selection process is. That's where everybody quits. That's where Hell Week is. And we hadn't had a recruiting film. There were no movies or no TV shows. Nobody knew what SEALs were. It was all classified on purpose. And we were brought into a room and they said, okay, all you senior listed SEALs, you know, what are your thoughts? How can we entice and attract young people to join the Navy, one, and then volunteer for the SEAL teams? And nobody wanted to say anything because, first off, we're not supposed to tell anybody about the SEAL teams. So all these people had at least, you know, at least 8, in a lot of cases, 12 to 15 years in the Navy. And so nobody wanted to do it at all. And the commanding officer kept trying, pushing. And finally, after a while, and that was a brand.
So before then, it wasn't like you saw these fancy recruiting things. Nobody knew about SEALs. Nobody talked about SEALs. It was like a secret. And you only became one. Did you become one also from just being in the Navy, and then you went into being a SEAL?
Right. And back then, most of it was word of mouth, either in the fleet where the ships are, or family members of SEALs, or, you know, it was very, in a very small community. There was only about, I think it was about 250 SEALs total in the Navy back then. Now there was like 3,400. Wow. And then there were what were called frogmen or UDT, underwater demolition teams. And they all went through BUDS, and then they would either go to a SEAL team, which focused on jungle warfare, or they would go basic underwater demolition SEAL training. That's the basic 6-month course that you start with.
So all SEALs learn how to do demolition?
Right. And all UDT frogmen in those days would go through BUDS too. And then we would split. Okay. And some would go to a SEAL Team 1 or SEAL Team 2 on the two coasts.
Okay.
And others would go to an underwater demolition team. And the underwater demolition guys would focus on beach landings and reconnaissance around the beaches. And the guys who went to the SEAL teams would focus on jungle warfare and kind of Vietnam era stuff. So the the commanding officer after a while wasn't getting anything out of anybody. And it wasn't too long before that where the Marine Corps came out with a great commercial. Completely different. Because up to that point, the volunteer military was all about see the world, get a college education. That's what all the commercials were about, right? It wasn't about what you're really supposed to do with the training, like go to war and fight as a warrior or not. And the Marine Corps came out with this commercial. I said, that's what we need. We need something that isn't about information, but kind of hits to the heart of a young person that wants to do something big or, you know, challenge, have to take a challenge that's difficult. And so then I realized why nobody else was saying anything. Because by saying something, the commanding officer had the one person in the room that had even any indication he might be interested. And so they put the project on me. And so I became the guy in charge of the recruiting film. Just like that, just from opening my mouth. So we ended up creating it. It was my kind of a side job because I was there as an instructor for 2 years. It took us about 6 months to film everything. The beginning, which I think you're going to show, is an attack. That's kind of get you fired up part. And then it goes into the three phases of BUDS, explains that with a narrator explaining it, giving information to the potential candidate. And then it goes into what you do in the SEAL team. So there's Arctic warfare, jungle warfare, desert warfare, all that. It's about 23 to 26 minutes, something like that. And that was the recruiting film, the only recruiting film for 15 years. It was translated like 26 different languages.
So, but the point is that you raised your hand and spoke up when no one else would, because you had a vision, you had a dream, you saw something that would make a difference, and you opened your mouth, right? You could have been like all the other guys and not said anything, but, and that, if that movie was the recruiting film for 15 years, obviously it worked, right? So you had an impact on the SEALs, even though it might have been annoying that they picked you for that. But really, you saw something that other people weren't willing to say. And that's what your book's about.
That's true. And, you know, in retrospect, having written a book about this very thing, I think I struggled against it because I realized as soon as I got assigned the project why all the other wiser gentlemen in the room had kept their mouths shut. Because they knew where this was going. Somebody was going to get picked as an advocate or something. So the first person to open their mouth is probably going to be nailed with the project. But the other thing is, I didn't know anything about how to do this. I didn't know anything. You know, I hadn't been writing books or anything. I was probably 27 years old, 28 years old. And back in those days, I had to go to the library to learn how to write a storyboard, a screenplay, not a script necessarily. And kind of lay the whole theme of the whole 23, 26 minutes, chunk it up, put it together. And every time I thought I had most of it done, I found I'd only done 2% of the project. You know, I think I told you yesterday that my last week and a half that I was there before I went to Officers Candidate School, I was sitting there trying to match the narration that I wrote to the actual visual. I'm trying to track it. And now I'm still working on it because every element of it was something that was brand new to me because I wasn't a professional. I wasn't a producer. I wasn't a director, a filmographer. I wasn't an audio specialist, but.
But did you, so being honest here, was it fun? I mean, in retrospect, did you enjoy doing it, or was it just a pain in the, you know what? Like, did you enjoy having the challenge of learning something new, or no?
I would go into school at night. I had a brand new baby, a second one about to be born, and I had my day job, and this thing was so much more consuming than I thought it might even be. I was supposed to be a technical advisor. That was the initial assignment, and I ended up being the whole darn thing. So to answer your question, it wasn't until we did a screening of the first 4.5-minute opening attack scene for a bunch of SEAL officers, because they wanted to see where we were on the project. And we had that cut, edited, and some music put over the top of it. And I actually felt like I might have some creative capability, because when the clip was done, and we saw, I mean, it was in a room with really nice speakers and everything, with, you know, so it was really good, much better than you'd find, you know, now on YouTube or whatever. But when it was done, the lights came on, they all looked at each other, and they turned back and looked at me like I had three heads, like, you did that? And I realized, wow, I did that, right? Yeah. It was my vision, my thought, and then all that struggle of trying to find the pieces and the parts, and, you know, trying to find somebody to give me the USS Ranger and aircraft carrier for 45 minutes at sea. All those things suddenly just kind of, they weren't a problem at all, because I saw the end result of it. And not doing this for a living and not being trained to do this, I didn't even have that concept of potential success or completion in my head, because I'd never put anything like that together before. From that point forward, it wasn't so bad, because I said, okay, this is going to be okay. It's going to look good. And the hardest part was the first 4.5 minutes, because it's kind of like a movie as opposed to a series of, you know, narrated shots of people doing different things.
Right. Wow. But it's really something that you just, but that's like, okay, from reading your book and reading all the stuff you wrote, that's who you are. Like, you just take stuff on and you don't worry about knowing how to do it or whatever, like finding a health business or a something else business? What was the other business?
Government contracting.
Yeah. And you just went after a business you didn't know anything about. Like, that seems to be what you grab. I don't know if you want it. Like, it seems like you like to do that. It seems like that's part of who you are. You're like, you're a SEAL. Not everyone can be a SEAL. Not everyone, you know, the statistics you were giving me yesterday were pretty low. Out of 120, out of 500, well, 75% attrition. Let's go with that. You know, like, yeah, you are that kind of person that does that, right? Not everyone is. So what I was wondering as I was reading the book or after, you know, the creative, be different, be creative. Do you think, well, I have a quote. Wait, hold on. Let me see. This is what I wrote. That you said, as we get older, there's a regression of natural abilities, not a progression of maturity. That it's not maturity that we don't speak up and we don't take on things and we don't be different and we don't be creative. It's that we've regressed and gone into the stability, or don't rock the boat, or, you know, you could have said, hey, I have, you know, one kid and a kid on the way. I'm not going to speak up. They might get mad and fire me. I mean, you're in the government, so that's a whole nother story. But, you know, do you think that this book could be, or that people would want to adapt it, you know, given that they're in that place of don't rock the boat, let me just get through till I get my pension or my retirement, if they even have one anymore. You know, I don't want to lose my job. I have family to feed. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. You know, like, do you think it's just the whatever percent of people like you, or do you think we all have that? Do you think, yeah, you know what I'm
convinced we all have it, unless you have, you know, a health problem with the function of your brain. You have the same mechanical parts. It's like a heart versus a heart versus a heart. It's got the same valves. It might be slightly different in size and all that, but unless there's some illness related to it, you have the same biological organ, the brain. And that's, when I was researching this and learning about this and and then decided to write the book and continue to talk to brain scientists and educators and other people that were involved in trying to understand creativity and imagination and things like that. I started out thinking that you did become mature, that you did, maybe it was puberty or something, you stopped thinking big thoughts and crazy thoughts, and you became an adult. You know, that was the point. You were supposed to go through your childhood and become an adult, not have childish thoughts when you were an adult, because that was childish. And that's how everybody talked. That's how all the people around you talked. That's how all the people in institutional authority, schools or churches or families, you know, they're all trying to groom you to become that adult, right? And then you get into a job and they're all trying to groom you to become that mature professional. And for some reason, what got left out of that was thinking big and dreaming and being inspiring and having any kind of aspirations to grandeur other than average. And that was okay, because that's not supposed to be what you're thinking. That's not the way it happens. Once you hit, you know, 17.5 years old, you're supposed to start acting like you're 72 years old. And so once I found out that the brain allows you to think this way, and I read some studies that showed that the real reason why six-year-olds have a 98 percentile score on creativity tests and four-year-olds have a 5% score.
Wait, four or
continually score. So it goes 40. So it goes from
40. Okay.
Six years old, so you're in the top 90th percentile on the scoring for creativity, like an aptitude for creativity. At 14, it goes down to 75%. At 24, it goes down to 40%. Excuse me, 25%. And then when you're 40 years old, it's down to 5%. And this is a long duration study. And their conclusion was that it was institutional learning, education, and the social structures that were all come from the same institutions and the same formative influences that had crushed and smashed and pushed us into this compliant, obedient state of thinking. And that it was nothing mechanical. There's no reason why anybody couldn't be creative. And then when you throw the brain science in there, brain scientists go, yeah, so we've discovered there's these two switches. And one's a task-oriented focus switch, which allows you to focus on things. And ancient humans, they needed this so they could create a needle out of a piece of bone and do all these finite tasks. But then they had this other switch called the forager switch, which is a fancy way of saying looking for food. And it's also called the explorer switch. And that was the risk-taking switch. Because if you stayed in the same valley and you ate every nut and berry and killed every, you know, living thing, eventually you were going to starve to death unless you got the gumption up to go over the ridge to the next valley. And you had to switch to the explorer foraging switch, and you had to start taking risks. You had to get out of your comfort zone. You had to go out. You had to find another place that was safe and was fruitful and would sustain the tribe or the group. And then you'd move them all there, and then you shift back to the focus tasks until the same. And it kept going over and over again, which is why humans were able to live, invent tools, stay alive, and then would migrate wherever the food was. Because if they had never had the audacity to actually take a risk, they would have sat there and just starved to death in that valley. So those two switches are part of our brain mechanics. And if you're 70 years old, 60 years old, 50 years old, so what happens? We get rewarded from probably around 10 years old-ish. You get rewarded for every time you act more adult and more mature, which means more task-focused. And you get penalized, or even maybe ostracized, if you try to act more carefree and inspiring and audacious and inspiring. All those things kind of bring this weird kind of negative reaction. I want to be a rock star. No, you don't. You know, I want to do this. No, you don't.
Get
I want to be a painter. No, you don't. Yeah.
Right.
So
when do you think that shifted? When do you think, I know you were talking about, you know, conforming people and having them fit into a certain mold, and it's a way of control. And if you know, like with the memorization in school, you know, that doesn't require thinking or being creative. Like, when do you think it switched?
I don't know.
Does it not matter?
There's a couple of stories in looking at it. Historically in the United States, because it's different everywhere around the world, different timelines. In the United States, it seems like the industrialization of education really kicked into gear in the 40s and 50s. And that then inspired the industrialization of large businesses in the United States after World War II. And everybody was copying everybody. So if you're going to be trained in how to run a plant, you're going to be trained in that same rote memorization, simple, linear, listen, observe, practice, perform under observation, get checked out, and then you do that task. Before that, say from the 1930s backwards to the beginning of this country anyway, everybody that came here were pretty much full on that explorer switch. They were trying to get away from the overburdened societies in Europe where everything was controlled and everything was owned by the state and you had no freedom. So they come to the United States and they had no problem with going over three ridges, two valleys, and a mountain range. They would try anything and everything. So there were more entrepreneurs. Virtually everybody was an entrepreneur. People had multiple revenue streams and multiple ways of making a living. And families were like their own little businesses and all this went on. But then it all kind of got put under one format with public education, the turn of the 20th century, and even got heavier when we started going into the 1950s. And not every country followed that exact path. You know, we eventually got rid of things like rhetoric and logic and Latin and understanding the Greek philosophers and all that, which is all about expanding your mind and the way you look at the universe. It's perspective building, right? And we threw that all out the window for algebra, you know, and memorizing dates and names in our own history and things like that. So I think that's how we're going to happen.
Interesting. And do you think there was a reason, or do you think it was just the way it went? I mean, they weren't saying, let's control their brains and have them stop being creative.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good books out there. Pete Hegseth wrote a book, I think it was last year, was published about education, the history of education in America. But I read this in other places where they referenced that public education was expensive, but Europe had already started it. And one of the boons was in Europe was they were getting better employees. They're getting a better workforce because the industrial age was really kicking into gear. So people were coming off of farms into the cities and they were coming off of doing things like farming and into factories. And this was no longer an ancestral apprenticeship handing down from your father, whatever. Now you had to go in and learn how to use some weird machine and be trained to learn the machine. So there was a lot of emphasis on how do we do that, even though the more altruistic people were saying we need an educated population of citizens sufficient to the level that they can make good choices when they vote, because that's part of the original promise of the Declaration of Independence and the Founding Fathers was if everybody's an idiot and for, you know, half a glass of whiskey, they'll do whatever you say and vote whatever way you want, which was happening a lot in the early part of our country. That kind of negates the whole point of citizenship and the responsibility of citizenship. So public education started to pick up more steam because they felt that was a way of protecting the basis of democracy. And I think there's even a line, you know, an educated or an aware citizenry is like the foundation of a healthy democracy. So public education helped towards that too. But there was a lot more civic information in the early days that's been stripped out. There was a lot more understanding of how the United States works as a government, works as an economy. Nowadays, you walk up to almost anybody in the street, younger than about 50, I'd say, and you say, you know, did you know that the United States is a republic and not a democracy? And they don't know that. And then you say, what's a democracy? They all know that. What's a federal republic? They don't know the difference between those two. I was taught that when I was a kid in the early 60s. So that used to be part of the education. That goes to the citizen angle of public education. So I'm not going to be cynical and say it was all about making better worker bees, but I think that the citizen part was probably a good part of it and inspiration, but even that's kind of drifted away now.
How does that happen, right? I mean, that's part of who our country is and all that. Like I'm just looking at how do we let it happen? How did it happen? Yeah. You know, and what are we raising here? You know what I mean? What's the next generation? They don't even know. Yeah.
Well, you know how they started making a push about 10 years ago, about critical thinking skills?
Yeah.
And they're trying to institute that in schools. The problem with critical thinking is And this goes to a larger theme. The reason I did well with that movie was because I had a senior officer that gave me my room and was very supportive of me. Almost every creative thing I did in the SEAL teams, I can point to somebody who saw the point and realized that I had a knack for something and let me go. They didn't stomp on me. They didn't shut me down. I worked for other people that did that in the Navy. But whenever I was under somebody that was enlightened like that, which is the same thing you'd have to have in a company to start inspiring people to be creative at any age and all that, you have to lead from the above, from the top. You can't create an atmosphere where everybody's afraid to raise their hand. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how many books you read or how many podcasts you watch. But back when this concept of critical thinking started to be discussed, my concern was critical thinking means you have to see all angles. You have to learn all sides. And is the education system in the United States willing to talk about all sides? What's the positive of socialism? What's the negative of socialism? What's the positive of communism? Or negative communism? What's the difference between communism and socialism? You know, what's a pure democracy and why did they all fail? And what's the difference between that and what our founding fathers put together and why does that work? These are and then once you've seen all that, or religion's the same thing, then you can debate and have a critical thought. And critical thinking is really the ability to debate and weigh and have different perspectives. It's not about rote, follow line of thinking. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think it was lip service, because the education system, at least publicly, seems to be more and more about you have to learn what we say is important, and you have to learn it the way we say you have to learn it. And if you want to be creative, do that on your own time.
Right. I heard I think it was a Tim Ferriss interview with someone who was a master debater. You know, that's where they learned, I forget who and I forget what, but they had to debate both sides. They didn't just learn one side. They had to defend both sides, which I think is so valuable, right? Because
right. I mean, that's why
you can't be right. You can't just be right about your side. You got to be able to defend the other side, which I think is so important. And I think if we did that, you know, let's just say what happened with the election and people were on one side or the other. And if you're not on their side, you're an asshole and, you know, you're a stupid or whatever they called the other side. I won't even say which side, but, you know, if let's just say we both, all of us had to be on the other side defending them. And then on ours, like we would have seen it from both sides. The country might have been different. We might not have been divided. We might have, right? I mean,
and it used to be an art. It used to be an art form. It used to be an art form to be able to convince somebody using logic and deductive reasoning and all these things. And that used to be taught. And that's why I didn't want to badmouth the rest of the world, because there's places in Europe where they still teach this. It's kind of like what they call the Jesuit method, but it's instead of rote memorization of facts and figures, you basically use that to form your arguments. It's a little bit different angle, right? It's like I've got all my Legos and everything, but I'm gonna create whatever I want to create, not what you tell me I have to create, and then I'm gonna make my pitch that what I created it was the right choice. And here's my pros and cons and my logic behind it. And it causes the brain, because that's the way the brain is actually designed. Carl Sagan wrote a book called The Dragons of Eden back in the 1980s, and he talked to brain scientists, and he was astonished to find out that the brain doesn't function as a big library or big storehouse. It actually functions as a thinking machine. That's how it's designed. And we force it through this particular type of education to memorize all kinds of crazy stuff and formulas and things. I mean, I've never used algebra ever. And I had to take algebra. I had to take it at school. I had to take it in the Navy. I had to take it in my undergrad. I had to take it in my MBA program. Never, ever, ever used it. But it's taking up space somewhere in there. What he realized was that the human brain is designed to assimilate and interact with all kinds of different elements of information and to question and to hypothesize and then come up with conclusions. Usually from the primal standpoint of, get the hell out of here, the tiger's coming, or hey, let's grab that because I haven't had food in 3 days. I think that'd make a great meal. It's almost always about survival. What's the best thing for you? But that's the way the brain's designed to work. It's a problem-solving machine. Which is it's a creative activity to problem solve. So the brain is designed, now besides those 2 years, the brain is designed, you know, from the stem up to contemplate all kinds of inputs and try to come up with an understanding of the universe and the world around the person and to answer questions through inquiry and through interaction and questioning. It's not supposed to just memorize and move forward like a software product.
Mm. Wow. All right. On that note, we're going to take our commercial break and then we're going to be right back and we're going to talk. I can't believe we're halfway done, but we're going to talk more about Be Different. All right. With Marty Strong. Be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. They are an experiential social-emotional learning platform, and it's just what we're talking about. It's not just memorizing. You are actually experiencing being connected with people and experiencing problem-solving and exercises that really do make a difference. So check it out at KikoriApp.com. Schedule a consultation and bring it into your schools, teams, or businesses. And then I'll do a real quick book promotion because I want to get back to Marty. This is my first book, The Second Piece of French Toast. If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? And you can find out all about it in this book. And if you find yourself numbing yourself, this might be an inspiration for you. There is hope, and you can create a life you love even though you feel you're stuck. That's what I learned. And that's why I do this show, because it's a life I love. This one, Your Bullshit Is Your Blessing, is all about the two sides of life as I found them, one where everything kind of sucks and the other side where life is fun and how to spend more time on the fun side. So if you find yourself on the nasty side, check out this book. You can find them all on Amazon. And this one is about speaking up. It's kind of what Marty did to get assigned that video. He spoke up, for better or worse. But this is for people who may be afraid to speak up. Anyway, check it out. You can go to realtalkwithhillary.com. Check it out, read it, and take the quiz, and then schedule a time to talk to me if you find yourself stuck as well. And now we're going to bring back retired Navy SEAL, author of 9 novels, 3 business books, and CEO, Marty Strong. Okay, so you're talking about the brain, and I do a lot of transformational programs, and one of the things we do is inquiry. And we say, we pick a topic and we say, looking newly, you know, what do you think about whatever? And it really is hard to look newly without taking all your past and, you know, having it be, you know, without having your past there and all your opinions and stuff. Looking newly, putting all that stuff over there, what can you see? And it takes something, but it's like a practice. But it's fascinating when you can actually do that. So what would you say to people? I mean, I was actually looking, because we were talking yesterday about, you know, the voices that stop us from speaking up or stuff. And we were looking at contribution, and I said, you know, I'm just afraid to really accept that I make a contribution. And at some, you know, young conversation, and the person I was talking to said, well, I have that too. And she said, maybe that's not a personal conversation. So like, maybe what stops us is not personal, but it is what we've inherited in school with the memorization, with, you know, don't do that, Johnny, don't do that, don't be angry, don't be this, don't be that. Like, we've been taught that, we've inherited it. And how do you think we could be different? How do you think, you know, when we've been taught to survive, and I'll eventually stop talking and let you answer, how do we set aside our survival mechanism of our kids to feed or this or that and allow ourselves to be creative? And now I'll mute myself so I stop talking. Go ahead.
So, you know, I have a practical day job, and that in that day job, I'm managing people and money and outcomes, and I report to a board, and there's private equity guys on the board, and so they're asking their questions. So it's kind of like, you know, SAT time all the time. That part of it's not very creative, but when people talk to me and ask me questions about creativity, innovation, you know, inspirational types of things, in solving problems, in dealing with a challenge of some sort, I kind of codified it, put it in the book. I have a 3-step process. So the first step kind of addresses what you were saying, Hillary. The first one's intellectual humility. So the way I describe intellectual humility, step one, is that you have to get rid of and release all the great stuff and all the bad stuff that you have in your baggage tray up there. So an example would be, you just got a bonus, you just got a raise. You were just noted in an article in a major magazine in your industry. And so you're, you know, all fluffed up and happy and, you know, feeling like you're on top of your game. And you've solved 2 or 3 projects and everybody's like, you're the man, you're the woman. And that's on the reward side. What happens if you step into each engagement of a challenge? You walk in the room, somebody goes, we got this problem. If you step in with that mindset, you already have a built-in arrogance based on your past success story. So you're going to start using formulas and football plays and methods immediately responding because you feel confident and comfortable because it worked yesterday, it worked 10 years ago, it worked 5 years ago, and you're just going to play. You're not going to listen. You're not going to look around. You're not going to try to learn anymore. Why should you, right? Worked before, it's going to work now. On the negative side, it's you just went through a divorce, you wrecked your car, you didn't get your bonus. Not only that, you were put on the, you know, probation list. You might even lose your job and all that. And you walk in, and so your attitude is you don't want to take a risk, you don't want to take a chance, you want to just roll over with everybody else's opinion because you don't want to have ownership and accountability because you feel like you have no sense of control anymore. Right. So both of those have negative impacts on looking at a challenge. It colors the way you look at it. So the humility part is basically clear all that stuff out and allow your mind to do the next step, which you can't do unless you're humble, and that is to be intellectually curious. Mm. And the way I define that is if you wrote down on a piece of paper all your sources of information, whether it's in your job or in your life, and you wrote them all down, you're probably amazed that there's not that many sources. If you put down the names of the people that you ask for advice or you go to for support in a question that has to be answered, again, you'll find that it's not very many people. Well, that's your little universe. That's what you've created, and it's comfortable, and it's very narrow. That's not curious at all. Curious means you blow way outside of those barriers. You go and talk to people that you've never talked to before. You engage people in maybe industries that have nothing to do with your industry. you look 360 degrees for insight, information, inputs. You talk to the lowest level employee about what they're seeing, if it's something to do with the company. You talk to the clients that you've never talked to because there's three layers of people between you and talking to a client. You do all of that. You watch webinars, you read books, whatever it is you can do. Until you, in the time that you have allotted, and then you say, okay, I've absorbed all this information. I have not made a conclusion because I'm humble. And being curious, I have all this information sitting in front of me, all this insight. And then the third step, which is being intellectually creative. Because you can actually be intellectually creative. You can function and make a constructive set of decisions and choices with the best information you were able to gather from all the different sources that you entertained. And you did it with a mindset that didn't include either a negative sense of failure or abhorrence of risk-taking or an overactive ego thinking that you're the answer to everything. And you practice that with every single solitary challenge that comes your way. If you practice it all the time, personally and professionally, I guarantee you, within about a month, you'll find yourself calmer when the challenge hits you. Your people will start realizing he's going to say, okay, I need to know this, and that. And has anybody talked to this? Has anybody talked to them? Has anybody looked into this? So I'm going to start coming with a lot of that input already because he's going to shift to that 360 degree curious mode. And I want to be prepared for that. And then they know what that leads to. A wide open whiteboard discussion of how are we going to solve this thing? How are we going to reimagine, reinvent? And it works. Those are the three steps. I was clearing that page.
Can you give an example?
I can give, I've got a specific example, names and all that stuff. So I'm a CEO of a healthcare company. And let's say that there's a decision or concern about an employee's performance. And it's a high-level employee, so they're a key employee. And there's been some altercations. There's been some psychological exchanges, negative, between some of my leaders and this employee. And I walk in. It's a Tuesday. I'm having a good day. I finished a workout. And I walk in, and the first thing that's thrown at me is we need to let them go. This happens a lot with business leaders and business owners. We got to let her go, let him go. And it's very firm. It's very definitive. And it's, case closed. And you can say, well, I trust you and I trust your judgment. And you say, okay, so I've always trusted you in the past. You've always been good at picking whether they should or shouldn't stay or whatever. And so I'm just going to say yes, because I've never been burned in the past and I'm just going to go with your flow. Now, that could be a way of demonstrating loyalty, but it's definitely not using those three steps I talked about. And so what will get you in the three steps, and in this situation, what it gets you to is you ended up repurposing, right? In our case, we ended up repurposing this person for a slightly different job function and focus, groomed them and mentored them over about a 6 or 7 month period until they hit their stride, because they were smart enough to take on almost any task given enough time to become proficient at it. And now they're kicking butt. Now that's a different outcome than if I walked in on a Tuesday before I even got my cup of coffee and said, yeah, whatever you want to do, I trust your judgment. So we still trust that person's judgment. It's just, let's go through this process of making the best creative decision.
And what was the problem, like, with the person? Was it just personality?
It was a change of leadership above the person. Mm-hmm. And that person felt like they had autonomy and they were being kind of held in check. Rightly, wrongly, whatever, they hadn't been used to that for a couple of years. And so there were sparks flying and everything. And, once people start doing that, tit for tat, and next thing you know, I've got a grudge. I'm gonna move that up the chain of command. And all of a sudden, the whole chain of command wants to be loyal. So everybody's got a head of steam. They come to you and they're like, go on, right? And that wasn't the right way to do it. Now, being objective is a good trait for a leader,
mm-hmm.
or for a parent, or for a spouse, because you walk into your house and you got the same thing. Something's happened and you've got all this stuff in the back of your mind from work or for whatever happened, a bad drive, and you don't react with a clear mind. You don't react with a humble mind. You react with, what's the fastest way I can get rid of this thing that just confronted me, whatever that thing is, a teenager problem, a kid in school problem, whatever it is. And it's not really using your brain. Your brain's capable of sitting, studying, thinking through things, and coming up with fairly decent choices and decisions, if you let it. It also lowers the stress if you have that methodology. Especially if you make a couple of really bad knee-jerk decisions, you realize you own that too. So you make less of those kinds of knee-jerk decisions and reactive decisions, and you start to kind of streamline a better way of leading, especially with people.
So would you say that you're like finding out what actually happened instead of just knee-jerking the decision? Like, I mean,
yeah.
So you're releasing the good and the bad. You're intellectually curious, so you're finding out. In that case, there's not, you know, a lot of marketing or, you know, research to do, but just finding out, like,
right,
what's going on here, and finding out, is that what you would do there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Same kind of thing, kind of an HR thing. Years ago, I wasn't in the office. I was the president CEO of another company, and it was a Friday afternoon, and a leader at one of our sites in a different state called up and said, I want to get rid of this person. They're not doing this, and this. And the person that worked for me took the call and said, okay. And then they went into the CEO of the company and said, hey, Marty's not here. I just got this call, bum, 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 bum. And the CEO says, okay, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to fire him. No, go ahead. So then he does that. So then I come in Monday morning and I'm getting coffee, and one of the bookkeepers says, oh, it's so bad to hear that they got rid of so-and-so. Like, who got rid of what? Because we weren't a very big company at the time. Well, they fired him on Friday. And I go, who fired him on Friday? Because I'm supposed to be the person responsible for hiring and firing and all that.
Oh.
So when I looked into it, it turned out that they just assumed I would go with that. And as a loyalty thing, we'd back the play of the person at the site, you know, physically out there. And I said, well, you know, why don't we find out what's really going on? So we sent somebody down there. We sent two guys down there, kind of as a surprise, just to look around. And they found out that the person, the site leader, was actually breaking all kinds of rules. He had talked everybody on the site into signing letters of intent with a competitor for a new contract that was coming up. And the person that he fired had caught him at it and was going to tell us. So he made up a bunch of stuff. But we did. So we brought him back in. We actually paid to have him flown in. And without him knowing how much we knew, we said, so what do you think's the reason why he wanted to get rid of it? So he just told us all the stuff that was going on that we already knew. So we reinstated him. We fired that site leader and we promoted another guy. But that whole process took about 10, 12 days. And so the right answer required some thoughtfulness, some inquiry, some open-minded, you know, inspection and curiosity. And then you got confirmation because you did all those things the right way. So the first one probably would have been a normal function in most companies. You know, this leader says, get rid of him. This leader says, I'm back in his play. This leader up here has hiring and firing authority. Goes, whatever you guys say, I'm going to back you. But I just know from being in the Navy for 20 years and then being in business that the power to hire is a small power. The power to fire is a big power. And some people can get a little bit consumed with that power. And they don't think their way through and what they're doing to somebody in their life or to the organization. You know, all the training and time and stuff that you put into that person, now you've got an empty spot. You got to start from scratch. So that's probably the best immediate example of where a challenge like that, but there's other things you could use that are mechanical challenges, financial challenges, et cetera.
Wow. Woo. All right. So what else do you want to say? We got like 5 minutes. What, anything you want to bring up, or you want me to go to my questions, or?
Well, you can go to your questions.
All right. I have one going way back. How did you, if they weren't recruiting for the SEALs, I think you enlisted, right, to escape. That was part of your escape. You enlisted in the Navy. Yeah. How did you end up in the SEALs?
So I went to a shopping mall in Omaha, Nebraska with some friends of mine to join the Marine Corps. I saw a video of guys going up and down these hills with big, huge backpacks on. I chickened out. I went over to the Navy guy because my dad was in the Navy for 4 years during the Korean War. I got his card. I eventually signed up with the Navy when I was 16 to go in when I was 17. And I was going to go in to be the same thing as my father. My father was a radar operator. So I was going in. They changed the job a little bit. So the radar and air traffic control. So I was going to go and do that. I went to the school. And when the school was over, I graduated top of my class. So I got promoted. I got pickup orders. So I picked a ship in the Mediterranean because I wanted to see the Mediterranean because I like history. And there was a big storm hitting in Chicago. And I went up to get my orders and my tickets. And the guy read off my orders and he said, report no later than 0730 tomorrow morning to underwater demolition SEAL training, Coronado, California. And he handed me the orders and my records. And remember, I'm 17 and...
So you never went to the Mediterranean? You never made
Holland.
So they just picked you for it. They just picked you to be...
It was a mistake. It was a mistake. They weren't supposed to pick... The radar air traffic control was what was called a restricted job. So, because you had to have real high scores and everything to get into it. So they weren't even allowed to recruit for the SEALs from that particular job in the Navy. So I got to the airport, called my dad. He said, well, you know, I read the orders to him. He said, well, dad, well, son, it's the Navy. They call them orders for a reason. So get out there and find somebody and tell them there's a screw up because there's obviously a screw up. I got out there. I found somebody and they talked me into volunteering. And that's how I did it. Just like that. Wasn't that hard to talk Marty, a 17 and a half year old Marty, into much back then, especially if you were a high ranking, you know, instructor at Buds. But
did you know where they were? Did you already know what they were? No?
No.
What's it? You know, it's not a good fit. Yeah. That was like.
You made it sound like it was a big sports team, you know, like. He's asking me questions. Well, did you ever play sports? Yeah, I played football. Can you swim? Oh, yeah. And blah, blah, blah. And he goes, oh, these guys are like your coaches. If you screwed up, did they punish you? Yeah, to run laps or run the stadium stairs. Oh, yeah, they'll be the same way. No big deal. Yeah. So.
Wow. You had to go through the whole course and pass it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Just came in. So how'd you do that? How'd you do in that course? Were you number one?
I was fine. No, we had four officers. I think academically I beat one of the officers. We only had 13 graduates of that 126 starting class. I was the very worst runner in the class on day one. I was the very worst runner in the class graduation. So I was average at pretty much everything else. I probably did a little bit better academically than most, but, yeah, and then I saw my dad in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, where I graduated high school. And we had a beer in a bar, and I was trying to tell him what SEALs were because I had orders to SEAL Team 2. He had no clue what I was talking about. I said, well, they're kind of like the Green Beret. Still really didn't know much what I was talking about. And then I said, well, you know, it's like frogmen. He goes, what? We had frogmen on my destroyer in the Korean War. I know what frogmen are. Okay, there you go. That's what I am. I'm a frogman. And that made him happy because he understood what that was.
Now, what happened to the other people that didn't make it? Did they just go in the regular Navy?
You ate them.
You ate them? Yeah, they're good.
That's a great protein source. We sucked in all their fear and turned it into power.
No, where do they go? Do they go just back to regular Navy or do they just get out?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, nowadays they can get out. There's a different kind of deal. If they quit or whatever, they can get out of the Navy altogether. Back in those days, you went to a ship for the rest of the time you had in 4 year hitch. So, yeah. And they also whisked them away. As soon as they quit, they got out of the compound and over to the other side of San Diego Bay. And you never saw them again. And we didn't have internet and emails and all that.
But they were
snail mail.
Maybe they were.
So if you didn't exchange like an address with somebody, you never saw them again. That was the end of that, you know. It was it's kind of spooky.
Yeah, that's crazy. All right. So we actually have to wrap up. This has been a lot of fun. What would you like to say in closing? Like, what's your vision for your book? How do you want to make a difference for the world?
Yeah, so all three books have a different point The first one, Be Nimble, was about leadership under crisis. Some of the things we've already talked about, how to deal with all these internal and externally driven stress events and lead through it. And the second book, Be Visionary, was about creating a vision and then converting that into an actionable strategy. Be Different was different in that it is applicable, but it's also applicable to personal life. It's not just a pure business focus, but it's about how to understand what we've been talking about the baggage and how to get past that, and then how to reignite and relearn how to be creative and inspirational, and then basically how to use that in an organization to improve the organization. So first half was kind of the setup. The second half of the book is functionally, how do you apply this to make a difference and make things better?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for writing it. There's so many more questions I wanted to ask, but oh well, we're out of time. So I have to ask you off the air. All right. Well, thank you, Marty. It's been a lot of fun. Bye, everyone.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Hillary.
You're welcome.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.